Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, I'm George Chen.
And I'm Paco Romain.
And you're listening to SubDoc, a show where we talk to interesting people with strong opinions about their favorite documentaries.
And on today's episode, we discuss the amazing 1988 documentary, The Decline of Western Civilization 2, The Metal Years, by Penelope Spheris.
Yeah, we got the box set for this, and Decline 2 is the second in a trilogy, and this one focuses on the 80s LA glam metal scene, and the very quotable guys and occasional gals that made it famous.
And we were very lucky to have the head programmer of Alamo Drafthouse LA, Brett Berg, to sit down and talk to us.
Okay.
Fair enough.
Okay. We'll just start going again.
Do the huge.
All right. And we are here with our guest today, Brett Berg.
Hi, Brett.
Good afternoon.
Yeah.
I like the sun streaming in from the window. It gives it a real chill vibe.
Yeah. We do it right.
It's why the cats love it. They just... Every podcast we talk about the cat. I think it's fine. They just, it's perfect. I just want to sit in the sun and just let it absorb.
We have dream catchers all around, bongs.
Yes.
Lazy boys.
Some really creepy
those art.
Those are creepy.
Like the big eyes a little bit, but not quite, no.
Are those Marushkas?
No. Medras.
You guys remember those?
This is going to work great on a podcast, talking about the art.
Little boy building. In that one looks like a bedwetter.
Yeah.
He does look like a bedwetter.
That's what that, that's that darkening right by his feet. So, Brett, good to see you.
Yep.
I just saw you the other day, but we haven't seen each other in a very long time.
Yeah, I used to live in San Francisco. I would, whenever I'd see shows up there, somehow you would always be in the room.
No, I... Okay, wait. When were you living in San Francisco?
I wasn't. It was just whenever I'd be up there.
Oh, yeah. We would just be doing shows together. And we played shows together.
Mm-hmm.
Our bands played shows together. Yeah. I remember one of the main interactions I had with you about... I just had to be probably like 8 years ago, was when you were trying to do a screening of Terminal City Ricochet, right?
Yeah, you were working for Jell-O, right?
Yeah, and we were trying to like figure it out. And no one could find a print of it.
Mm-hmm.
It was very bizarre. And then I think... What he told me, and this bears out because I went to a thing at Cine Family where Stuart Smalley, is that his name? Stuart Smalley? Stuart Smalley
Shapiro?
The guy from Night Flight.
Stuart Shapiro.
Stuart Smalley is Al Franken's character.
Yeah, that's from Saturday Night Live.
Which, if you've never seen that movie, so soon, it's incredibly weird.
Yeah.
Weirder than you think. It's directed by Harold Ramis.
Oh, it is.
Directly after Groundhog Day, and he was the reason the movie exists.
Ramis.
I found this out recently that so Al Franken wrote a Stuart Smalley book that was kind of a New York Times bestseller.
Yeah.
And then Harold Ramis had been looking for a project to do after his success with Groundhog Day, and he fixated on the Stuart Smalley book, and he's like, Al Franken, we are turning this into a movie. And Al Franken goes, okay.
Yeah, sure.
And it's probably the weirdest movie of Harold Ramis' career. It's incredibly low-key. Uh-huh. All the jokes are kind of like very ethereal and kind of float and hang and don't land ever.
Uh-huh.
And it's got a great cast. Vincent D'Onofrio's in it.
Wow.
Harris Yulin, who's a great character actor, is in it.
What's it called?
Stuart Saves His Family. And it was destined to fail from the beginning.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating.
What year?
95.
Oh, okay, that late. Huh.
Yeah.
It's on Hulu right now.
Okay.
That reminds me of that same era where my bandmate from KIT, Christy, was obsessed with the It's Pat movie.
Mm. Oh, man.
Which has Dave Foley in it and it's very, they're driving instructors. That's the premise. And the whole, it's a 90 minute version of the It's Pat sketch, which is just like, Pat doesn't have a gender.
Yeah.
And like now it would be like you'd get so many Jezebel articles about that movie.
Oh, Lord. So many.
I bet you'd make it to the end of Stuart Saves His Family easier than you would the end of It's Pat. Like, okay. The 90-minute journey is a little tougher with mm-hmm. It's Pat.
Yeah. That's I actually saw It's Pat at the movies. Mm-hmm. I remember going to see that, and I just always felt like I got fucked by every SNL movie that would come out. I would just leave and just be like, why did I do this? Why did I give this one a chance?
Have we ever talked about Coneheads on this podcast?
Oh,
like
probably.
Coneheads feature film?
Yeah, it was so bad.
Daughter, surprisingly attractive.
Yeah.
And with that.
Wasn't there a Coneheads 2?
No, they did not make a Coneheads 2. But the Coneheads movie I'm a fan of, I think it's very psychedelic.
Uh-huh.
There's some moments in it which I cannot explain.
Yeah.
Like, they don't really follow comedy rules very well.
No, they Chris Farley's in it also, another one of our...
Oh, right.
Another one of Paco's big favorites.
I love Chris Farley.
Yeah, we did an episode about with the guy who directed the Chris Farley documentary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Brent Haji.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Chris is it. Yeah, SNL, man, I don't know why they can't go from sketch to film at all. Yeah. What's the most successful SNL film?
I mean, the Blues Brothers?
Wayne's World.
Much more than
it's a weird... I looked into this because I was fascinated by it. So you have Blues Brothers, 1980. It's kind of a fluke. There are no 80s SNL movies. Mm-hmm. So there's a 12-year gap, and then you have Wayne's World. Wayne's World is a huge hit.
Right.
Beyond expectations, like, they probably didn't expect it to be as big of a hit.
Right.
And then you have a slew, like, 8 other SNL movies in quick succession, and they all tank to varying degrees. Mm-hmm. You have Night at the Roxbury, Superstar... Coneheads, The Ladies' Man, It's Pat,
yeah.
Stewart Saves His Family. I might be forgetting one, but these all did not do very well.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then you see them disappear, and then they come back years later with MacGruber.
Oh, right.
That fails, and then you, again, have no SNL.
MacGruber, I will stand by, though.
That, really?
Yeah, MacGruber's
you liked it?
Got great moments in it.
And Wayne's World is directed by?
Penelope Spheeris.
Exactly.
Tying it back in. But before we get back into all that, so, Brett, you're also a programmer, and you used to be at CineFamily.
Yeah, I was the programming director there for 7 years.
Yeah, and how did you get in? And now you're with Alamo,
mm-hmm.
and you guys don't have a physical location at present, right?
Yeah, we were slated to be open. They hired me because it was supposed to be open already, and it won't be until sometime in 2017. So in the meantime, we're doing pop-up shows everywhere at different venues.
Now, do you guys have an eye on a place? Do mm-hmm. you have a lease on a place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
It's
much like San Francisco. It took a little bit to get off the ground from the time... The lease is signed, I know.
Yeah. Yeah, so we're going to be at 7th and Flower,
okay.
which is this new shopping mall called The Block. Formerly the Macy's building, they ripped the roof off, turned it into an outdoor courtyard shopping mall.
Downtown?
Downtown. And it's across the street from the 7th and Metro Hub, which is where the Blue, the Red, the Purple, and the Expo all come together.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get into film programming, like, back in the day?
Oh, by accident.
What's your transition from... Being like a music guy, or simultaneously, you were doing both, right?
Yeah, you will find that if you talk to almost anyone in film programming, that there is no clear path to it. People usually fall into it in one way or another. So there's no college courses, there's no textbooks, there's no guidance, there's no training program. You just kind of, everybody has their story. So I used to be the manager of a video store.
Oh, which one?
Cinephile.
Okay. So is that where Fadum worked?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was co-workers with Josh Fadum for many years.
That'd be interesting.
What?
To be a co-worker with Josh Fadum.
Oh, it's actually a breeze. He's a pleasure.
I bet. It'd be awesome.
We have a lot of ties to video stores, too. Running Lost Weekend Videos, the comedy shows down there, yeah.
Josh and I shared a funny moment at the video store once. So we had a... it's really demeaning to say favorite hobo, but out of all the personalities that would wander in and out of the store, we were up the street from a veterans hospital,
mm-hmm.
like the huge VA center in Westwood, mm-hmm. or like across the freeway from the Westwood Village.
Near UCLA, yeah.
Near UCLA. So a lot of folks who were residents of the VA facility in varying stages of out of their mindness would come into the store, and sometimes... they'd be fun. Sometimes they wouldn't be. So we had a favorite. I don't think he was living up there, but he was just on the street. His name was, we dubbed him Mozart because he would always come in, and whenever he heard music, he would start doing air guitar. So we just named him Mozart. One day, we were looking out the big picture window from behind the counter where we could see across the intersection, Santa Monica and Sawtelle. mm-hmm. very, very busy intersection, one of the busiest on the west side. So outside the kind of like bail bondsy, sell your diamonds and gold place across the street, Josh points and he goes, "Oh my God, is that Mozart fucking somebody?" And 2:30 p.m., Saturday afternoon, much like a day like this, there's Mozart with his pants around his ankles, balls deep in a homeless woman, and just pumping away on Santa Monica and Sawtelle. And they're going for a good minute or two, and then this cop car pulls up. There's a cop station in the neighborhood. And the car very slowly pulls up. The cops very slowly get out of the car. They shake their heads at each other, shrug, and then proceed to pull him off, the woman, and toss him in the car. And predictably, as his dick is flopping in the wind, he's like, "Wah, dude, blah, 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 blah." Toss him in the car, take him away. We never saw him again.
Whoa.
And Josh and I were behind the counter that day.
Oh, you could see from the counter.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I certainly hope it was consensual,
It appeared to be because the woman, it did not look like a struggle.
Right. They were both into it, which is like when you're homeless, it's like, yeah. That makes sense. What else are you going to entertain yourself with?
Exactly.
It's quite possibly it could have been non-consensual. It was just too difficult to tell from across the street and with no audio.
Yeah.
But anyways, Josh Fadem, love him.
And working in a video store, how did that lead into doing some programming?
Well, my ex-boss at CineFamily was also my ex-boss at the video store. So there were a couple owners, and our five-year lease was up in 2004, and Hadrian, who became the executive director at CineFamily, said, "Hey, we should expand. We should move into a bigger facility that could also have space for a micro cinema." And the other owner, Phil, at the time was not into it, and we ended up getting another five-year lease in the same place. So Hadrian became very disillusioned with the whole thing and eventually split off and formed CineFamily because the owners of the building, the silent movie theater building, the Harkhams, were a wealthy real estate family in L.A. and owned a bunch of stuff. They also owned Family Books. Sammy Harkham was a customer of the video store.
Oh.
And they ran into each other at the NewBev one night, and he told Hadrian, "Hey, we just bought the silent movie theater. Do you think you could do something there?" And thus, CineFamily was born.
Okay.
And so he fell into programming, and then a year later, I joined him over there, and I fell into it.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
As well.
From Fairfax, the Fairfax dynasty. Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome.
And
a lot of what we did at CineFamily that was so unique and special came out of our detective work in the video store, because the video store was full of rare bootlegs, things that had never been released in the U.S., and how do you find that stuff?
Mm-hmm.
We got very adept at that. That skill transferred over to finding guests, finding rare film prints, etc.
Oh, right, things cool. like Turkish E.T., things like of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen that?
No.
I worked at Green Scene, if you remember them.
I remember Green Scene. They were like the art house Netflix, basically.
Basically, plus porn. That was the main other additional aspect of it. And I worked in the shipping department up in San Francisco, like in disgusting Stevenson Alley, right off 7th and Market. And I was receiving back those packages, those DVD by mails. And when it was a porn,
oh boy,
I was like, me and some of the coworkers was like, we need like a lot of hand sanitizer.
Did you Lysol the packages?
We did not. We did a little clean on the actual disc itself. That was part of it. Back in that day, and those are the guys that ended up. One of the guys from Green Scene is a guy who does Fandor.
That's what I thought because it seemed like a natural through line between the two of them.
Yeah.
But yeah, Green Scene was really cool. I just don't remember there being much marketing.
Yeah, that was one of the things I think that was problematic with it. On top of which, I think what ended up happening in the end is they sold to someone down here, and I doubt they're still around. And like, I don't know why. Yeah, because the DVD by mail business has to be. And you worked at a video store too, so like, why would you use it? You know.
And from what I've heard, porn is pretty prevalent on the internet now, free.
Well, that was the interesting thing at the time because it was like. There were states where I think it was harder to get, and there were states where it's like, if you're like a closeted gay man, like in this Midwestern state, you got to get your DVDs by mail. This is a little before streaming that I was working there. It was like YouTube, I think, just had come out in 05.
Got it.
Yeah, so a lot of video store connections, and Like, did you ever do anything with these films, with Penelope Spheris, with the Decline of Western Civilization films?
We didn't do anything at CineFamily for a very long time, and we were in the same position that every other movie theater in the world was in, was that the rights were unavailable.
Is it because of IRS?
No, Penelope Spheris owned the movies and had for a long time, and she, for whatever reason, was uninterested in having them play theatrically or getting them out on home video in any form. And the story goes that her daughter, Anna Fox, was the one who pushed her to get that Blu-ray box set kind of like all wrapped up. She could have done it years before and for whatever reason chose not to. And the films were holy grails, both on disc and theatrically. And so only recently had CineFamily done anything. They showed Decline 2 earlier this year. Mm-hmm. It was great. She did a Q&A. She was so good. Mm-hmm. Ah, she's like a consummate interviewer and interview subject.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Actually, I noticed that you hear a lot more of her in Decline 2 as an interviewer. Her presence is felt a lot more.
Do you wish that you were a bigger star than you are right now?
Do I wish what?
That you were a bigger star than you are?
Not really. I wish I was a smaller star. I don't dig being the person I am. I just don't like it. Being the person who says, like, excuse me. Being who I am is like, here, watch.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Before we get into it, Brett, you're pitching to someone. Let's say you just meet someone at a wedding or something. You're like, hey, have you ever seen this documentary? This is why you got to see it. How would you describe Decline 2?
Well, there's two explanations. There's one for metal fans and there's one for non-metal fans. For non-metal fans, it's an incredible portrait of Los Angeles, both like style-wise and music business-wise in the mid-80s. And it's a scene that it's kind of ethnographic at this point. It's a scene that has totally vanished. Mm-hmm. For metal fans, it's a chance to see what they were up against at the time, because a lot of what's in the movie, like, metal fans now wouldn't call metal.
Right.
But I certainly would when I was like 10 growing up.
Yeah.
On the periphery of it.
Yeah, and what's your personal relationship with this film? You're saying that had to do with growing up.
Oh, here. God, it was probably this movie is the first documentary that I watched more than once. Mm-hmm. I first saw Decline 2 on commercial television in Los Angeles with commercial breaks on Channel 9. LA in the 80s and 90s had an incredible local television lineup.
Oh, yeah.
So many stations were playing R-rated movies in the daytime. Weekdays, weekends.
Really?
I mean, like, edited for content. Right. But I had a real heavy education in movies just by watching Channel 11, Channel 13 on, like, mm-hmm. Saturday afternoons. I bought a stack of TV guides at Eddie Brandt's the other day. Eddie Brandt's Saturday Matinee is the oldest continuously running video store in the country. It's in North Hollywood. It's got weird hours. I bought a stack of old TV guides from them last month because they were $2 each and they're all local LA editions. Oh. And I was just looking up a random one from 1993 And on a Saturday afternoon in 1993, on this one day, you had to choose between They Live and Gremlins because they were playing on two competing stations at the same time on a Saturday.
Nice.
So that was all that stuff was in the mix.
Yeah.
And Channel 9, I first saw Texas Chainsaw Massacre on Channel 9 with commercial interruptions. They had Kung Fu Theater every Sunday, and they would play weird stuff like Decline 2.
Wow.
And I taped it off TV and watched it over and over again.
With friends?
With myself.
Oh.
No, it was really kind of a solitary thing.
Yeah.
Of all the bands that are in this doc, were any of them your favorites? Did you have a particular favorite that was in this?
Probably Megadeth, because that was a band I was already kind of picking up on at the time. So I first started liking metal in fourth grade when, as a party favor, this is L.A. for you, as a party favor, I received a sealed cassette of Motley Crue's Girls, Girls, Girls.
Wait, so what does that mean as a party? You went to a party.
Like, I went to a birthday party as a 10-year-old.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes they give out little bags of, like, Snickers bars and, like, balloons and stuff.
Yeah.
When I went home, I found in my bag a cassette of Girls, Girls, Girls. Other kids got, like, Iced Tea's... Iced Tea's Power, the one with, like...
With the butt.
With the butt and the Uzi.
Yeah.
So, and those kids got into hip-hop subsequently.
Right.
I got into metal because I was given Girls, Girls,
Luck
Girls.
Luck of the draw. It was like someone was in the industry. Someone's dad was in the industry, basically.
Yeah.
Or like a distributor or something like that.
Yeah. And then I started listening to Motley Crue, not understanding what metal was, but liking them. Mm-hmm. And then kind of piecing it together in my late elementary school, middle school years. But also in middle school, my first crush was this guy who was like a guitar prodigy, and he was a Hesher. So, of course, I was into whatever he was into.
Right.
And he was into 80s thrash, so I got a quick education in Metallica, Megadeth, Slayer, Sepultura, Creator, Pantera, et cetera, et cetera.
Long hair.
Long hair.
Feathered.
No feathered. Just kind of
straight.
Just gross and stringy. Yeah. We were like eighth graders. Come on.
Eighth grade Hessians. I was friends with an eighth grade Hesher who was into Metallica, and I just found it all very scary. I was like, I like the Smiths, so I don't really know.
You're more emo. World.
I was more emo back then, for sure. I liked the Pogues a lot. That was the other thing I was really into.
What about Iron Maiden?
He wasn't really into the British stuff, so I got into Maiden, Priest, etc. Much later, I want to say college.
Got it.
Yeah.
And did you have a favorite pin on your jean jacket? Did you wear a jean jacket? And if so, did you have a favorite pin?
No jean jackets, no pins. I was living in isolation, not really understanding the world of it, just purely hearing the music. Also, KNAC, 105.5 KNAC, was the metal station in L.A., and I was able to listen to it in its last few years before it went away.
Okay.
It was really instrumental. In fact, there were two metal stations at one point. There was KNAC, and then there was Pirate Radio, what they called Pirate Radio, 100.3, which was the frequency that later became... I'm mixing it up. I'm thinking of Indie 103.
Right, Indie 103.
Different entirely.
Which I know just because they did comedy. Bang Bang started there. I know the Comedy Death Ray started out of that.
Yeah.
That was like Steve Jones was like one of the people there.
Mm-hmm. So I was listening to metal on the radio, on Headbanger's Ball.
Headbanger's Ball, yes.
And like through my friend Dave. Mm-hmm. But never going to shows, never commiserating with people outside of my one or two friends that were into it also.
Had Dave seen this movie, this doc?
He must have. I don't remember.
He
left the school I was at after ninth grade, and I think that's around the time when I had taped this off at TV. Mm-hmm.
So in this doc, I mean, like we were talking about before we recorded how much funnier and differently shot it is than number one, the first one about the punk scene in
LA. She has about 8-9 years of experience at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. She had also... So Decline 2 is way more stylish than the first one. Also, she had done a lot of music videos in the interim, so she probably had a better sense of lighting, camera work.
Yeah, there's more style. It's more stylized. And then, of course, there's these like weird rock and roll drum hits that like jokes.
Uh-huh.
You know, instead of like ba-dum tum, it's like
right.
You know, and I think that's
the camera work in that one interview with from Kiss
with Paul Stanley.
Paul Stanley. The overhead shot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's lying.
That's so dumb.
Prone with like three ladies draped across him.
Yeah.
It's like leopard print.
With his spandex pants on.
Yeah.
If you if you watch the film again, like I did last night, I was kind of like searching for things that I hadn't picked up on many times I'd seen it before.
Yeah.
In that, in one of those shots where it's Paul Stanley's in bed, he's got two or three groupies with him. Mm-hmm. He's going on about some complete horseshit thing, and the woman that's next to him, she's looking at him like what the fuck are you talking about?
Well, there's a moment when he talks about, she said, do you ever fall in love or whatever? And he's like, no, I don't have a, or like a favorite groupie, and I don't fall in love because like I can fuck as much as I want. And that woman in the white looks at him like, I'm like, fuck you.
That's the moment. I have a feeling that those ladies were hired as extras for the scene. So something else I realized recently, Decline 1, the concert scenes are incredibly raw because the shots of the band are being filmed at the same time as the audience. So with Decline 2, the vast majority of the concert footage, you can tell that the band is being filmed at a separate time than the audience, because you almost rarely see the band and the audience together.
Yeah.
I mean, with maybe a couple things like Megadeth, there's a lot of audience interaction, but like the Lizzie Borden thing, say, the band is filmed separately.
Right.
And they do film the band with the crowd, but none of that footage really makes it into it.
And it seems overdubbed, or it seems like they put the song on top of the footage. It's like flawless and perfect for a live venue.
But, you know, these are tricks of the trade. And it's perfectly acceptable to do it. It's just a different animal.
Right. And while we're on that topic, there is the famous scene we were about to get into earlier, which we find out later, the water in his vodka bottle, or the vodka is pool water, essentially. What's his name? Chris Holmes,
the guitarist from Wasp.
Yeah. From Glendale.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. So there's a lot of bands in this movie that no one's ever heard of because they didn't find success. The only band in the movie that really, you know, struck a chord clearly was Megadeth.
Right.
But all the other bands are these like pompous like half talented groups that I think didn't hit it big because most of them are kind of fugly.
Yeah.
You know, even though they have chops, they look kind of they got faces made for radio.
Yeah. Like Odin,
Seduce. Like London.
London seemed to be like
they're my favorite.
They were like, we've got a lot of famous alumni, but we're just here slugging it out.
They're like the closest to Spinal Tap out of this entire.
Yeah, the guy tries to light the flag on fire, and it's like flame retardant, so it doesn't catch on fire.
I'm trying to think of
the Russian flag.
Yeah,
I was trying to think of the timing because Spinal Tap came out in 85, I want to say.
A little earlier.
A little earlier. Yeah. So she was aware. It almost seems like it would have been the reverse. Like he saw this and then made Spinal Tap, but it's really more like...
That's the genius of Carl Reiner.
Yeah.
Rob Reiner.
I mean, Rob Reiner. Yeah, that's the genius of Rob Reiner, is that he...
This is having a son named Rob Reiner. Yeah.
What's that?
Carl Reiner's genius with having a son.
Right, yeah.
That
is the genius of Spinal Tap, is like it came out so early, and all the other stuff just kind of seems to replicate that, you know?
Yeah.
But London is... They're my favorite because they're just a bunch of fucking... they're not smart.
No, the guy, the singer's stage name is Nadir DePriest, which sounds like a Spinal Tap joke.
Yeah, it does.
And he, out of any character in the entire movie, he's the most repulsive, because he tells some story about like having sex with some girl and getting chained up, and then like,
oh yeah,
getting stuck there for days. Like, what's that Stephen King book, Gerald's Game?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Like the woman chained to the bed for the whole book.
Oh, God.
He just seems like a total sleazebag. I would love to know where he's at.
Yeah. I think of any... Like, if this movie had come out, like, this year, they would probably have gotten their own reality show, London. You know, like, that would be, the band that most people would want to see the failure of, you know?
And a lot of those bands were living the exact same life that Guns N' Roses were living. It's just that Guns N' Roses were more talented, more charismatic, and weren't ugly.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is. So then, we see it kind of opens on Paul Stanley and his room of seductresses.
Yeah.
And then we, you know, it goes through a bunch of Lizzie Borden, who I'd never heard of.
I've heard of, but I'm not super impressed.
They look older than the rest of the bands. Yeah. Like they're like showbiz veterans, kind of like Whitesnake.
Yeah.
We're all dudes in their 30s.
Right.
But it didn't help because they're lame.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like they have props. Like he has an axe, you know. I think that made me laugh.
Well, I was thinking about how, like, this is almost structured similar to a documentary that we have talked about, which is Comedian with Seinfeld, because there's like the established people where you don't even see the live footage, probably because they couldn't get rights for Kiss and Aerosmith songs, but you have Kiss and Aerosmith being like, they're already King of Shit Mountain or whatever at this point in time. They're past their commercial peak probably at this point.
Well, Kiss had done away with the makeup, and Aerosmith had just started their comeback.
They just after Walk This Way, too.
Well, and they just did Dude Looks Like a Lady, which was a huge hit. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a gigantic.
They don't have performances. Like, those guys don't have performances.
I saw one of the, I think the first rock and roll concert I ever saw was Aerosmith and Ted Nugent. They opened for Ted Nugent.
Sounds like Michigan.
Yeah, it's very Michigan. In Battle Creek, Michigan, I think we went to see, or maybe Kalamazoo, but Aerosmith was so fucked up. The entire band was so fucked up. Steven Tyler couldn't get through Dream on the piano. He tried a few times, and then he was just like, fuck it. This was like 86, 87.
I also have never thought of Aerosmith as metal.
I think like Toys in the Attic, like some of the early stuff, they were kind of like the, you know, the precursor.
Yeah, there's a couple songs. I mean, I think they're kind of problematic, but there's Aerosmith songs I enjoy, like Draw the Line.
Oh, yeah.
Draw the Line sounds to me the most like cocaine out of any rock song I've ever heard.
Uh-huh. they did a good job of summing up cocaine with that.
Yeah, they're called Draw the Line.
Yeah, I mean, come on. Yeah. It's funny, too, is like, because you see the older rock and rollers, Gene Simmons, who is I think he's always been sober. I don't think he's ever done drugs or alcohol that I know of. Aerosmith had just gotten sober. Alex Cooper, I believe, has always been sober. I don't think he had ever.
Oh, no. I think he talks about getting clean. I think,
yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Like, I did too much.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. It's just funny because I think she does a really good job. There's obviously some themes in this documentary, and I think she did a good job of presenting like the older guys who'd gotten sober and who are successful, the younger bands who are like, we're not interested in drugs and stuff. We just want women and money and success. And then the bands who are like, we want to just fucking party. You know, of course they want success, but they're really just kind of partiers.
Well, they don't know what success really means. They don't know that success means that you party and you compartmentalize it because the rest of the time you're working your ass off.
Right.
Poison is a great example. Those dudes weren't really about drugs as much as the other bands were, even though they probably did their dabbling. But they were successful because they were able to like lead a professional life. And they also were pretty.
Right.
And had great material.
Yeah.
And were more charismatic than Seduce. Or whatever.
From Detroit.
They actually seem like they're having the most fun of anyone in this documentary. Like, they genuinely are like, why are we being interviewed? We're dumb. This is stupid. Like,
which
they,
band?
Poison.
Oh, yeah. Poison, yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of people that are like showing off, peacocking. There's a lot of peacocking.
Mm-hmm. From the people that are the least successful.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And because it's in a way, it's like, this is what they have to get. Like, Gene Simmons, like, is. God, I keep thinking, I was telling my girlfriend about this last night. Have you guys all heard the Gene Simmons, Terry Gross interview?
Yes.
Oh. It's like pretty amazing because it's just like the rudest anyone has ever been to Terry Gross.
Yeah.
And like she's just like, wow, I just don't know how to respond to any of this at some point.
Yeah.
He's just like kind of the worst.
Yeah.
Out of
anybody in the film, he seems like he retook his lines a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
He also has makeup on. Like, a lot of these guys, even, I mean, not the Kiss style, but a lot of these guys have, like, theatrical makeup, you know, for the for the camera.
And, the thing I like about these failed bands is what I like. That's the ethnographic stuff or the stuff that reminds me of, like, Mickey Rourke in The Wrestler. And also, like, everyone I knew from, like, noise bands. Like, basically just kind of, like, this thing of, like, not... Yeah, just living this sort of life and not really not having clear goals about what it even means, and like having like just that kind of stench of like, well, I don't know, I'm gonna be 50 and still doing this, or I'm gonna die in a ditch, like that kind of attitude, which I think is like kind of fascinating. It's never really been like exactly how I think, but I always like relate to those people a little bit.
Yeah,
and like comedians, it's so much like comedy. Like I think like this. And, like, The Wrestler sort of is, like, this is, like, anyone who's in a creative performing field, like, identifies with those characters.
I think you have to have that, though, when you're young and first starting out, I think, which is that attitude of, like, I'm just going to make it. I'm going to do it. I don't have a plan B, and I believe in myself, you know?
Yeah.
Which, you know, and obviously a lot of those guys didn't make it, like Odin. Mm-hmm. They seem to have a lot of bravado. Yeah. They're like, we want to be the Doors.
Well, their songs suck, so they never were going to get there with that material that they present in the film.
Yeah, and the assless chaps.
Yeah, and the vocals I wasn't that into, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, like, so the people, yeah, like, the music.
Now, I say that the songs suck. I have a deep affinity for those people just because I enjoy the era, and I just like metal in general, and I appreciate their effort. But, the material's not there with a lot of these bands.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, not everyone can be Poison. You know?
Mm. You know, and bands like Poison, I'm sure, had ghostwriting help from pro songwriters.
Right,
which
yeah.
is something that Odin or Seduce or even Faster Pussycat probably didn't have.
Oh, yeah. I never thought about that.
Oh, yeah. You know, Michael Jackson didn't write all of Thriller.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, he was a genius to have other geniuses around him.
Right, right, right. Yeah, that's true. Quincy Jones and whatnot.
And Ted Templeton.
Who wrote all
that stuff. Who passed away recently.
So, and then, man, there's so much that goes on in this documentary. Like, Bill Gazzari.
Oh, Ben, is it Bill or Ben?
Ben Gazzari.
Oh, Ben?
Yeah.
I think it's making me think of Ben Gazzara. But, the older gentleman.
It's one of them.
One of the Gazzari, the Gazzari guy who has the contest of just who can be the most, like Heather Locklear metal lady. To dance around.
Yeah, the contest seemed like real chaos.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Total shit.
Yeah, and like he had his own club.
Yeah, which I believe is now the Key Club.
Oh, okay.
I think.
Yet another character that seemed like straight out of Spinal Tap. I could not stop thinking of Spinal Tap the entire time I watched it. This documentary made me laugh out loud so many times because I was just like, they're all kind of caricatures of themselves. It's so odd.
Yeah, and when you watch the film, you don't struggle with this in Decline 1 or 3, but in 2, you're always in the back of your mind, you're thinking, is this real?
Yeah.
Are these performances for the movie, or is this how these people live? And I think that performance was how people live. It's kind of a hybrid of two.
Yeah.
Like they're living a fake performative life.
They were LARPing.
They were LARPing.
Yeah, early LARPing.
Metal LARPing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they also feel like this is what they're supposed to look like and supposed to do, especially when the camera's on. But Bill Gazzari or Ben or whatever.
Yeah, Gazzari.
The contest man. That part was so odd when he has the... I like it, too, because he has this contest, for those people who haven't seen it, of...
It's just like a strip contest. It's like, who can look the best in a bikini or something?
Well, it was best in like rocker,
t-shirt. Yeah.
Rocker outfit, because at one point he says, like, hey, none of that, like, G-string stuff. Like, it was classy. This is a classy joint.
Yeah.
You know? And then they have a bunch of rock and rollers. I think Odin, right? Wasn't it the guys from Odin?
They're the guest panel. Judges.
They were the guest judges, too, like, of... Find out. Do you like? We have our cat is.
You're not like allergic,
cats.
Are you?
Yeah, they were like guest judges in this weird dance thing. And
yeah, which is it was, and they really disliked one lady for some reason. I think that she didn't really dance correctly or something. They just liked it when they were like unhinged.
Which
I kind of like, but also like that kind of brought me back to like just like how male this movie is. It's like way more even than the first one, where at least you've got like Xene and like Alice Bag and Frank and people like that. But this is like no female bands. A couple female. I want to say like it was Lita Ford in it.
They don't.
Someone references like, her.
Yeah.
And just a couple of women that were also in bands, but were also.
The level of misogyny in this movie is near suicidal.
Yeah, it's really insane.
But she.
It's representative of that scene, though, right?
Yeah, she is documenting it.
Yeah.
She is not diverting it or soft pedaling it. She is like, here are these dudes. This is what this is like.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of times she gives them outs, too, when they're like being extraordinarily sexist and misogynist. And she's like, well, that's not what you mean or stuff like that. And they're like, no, that's what. Like, this is all about getting laid and treating women like filth. And yeah, it's pretty incredible. But. I mean, that's what happens when you have 20-something dudes, I would think, especially at that time period.
Or late teens. A lot of those guys are late teens, early 20s.
Yeah.
And it also reminds me of comedy in that respect.
Yeah. So. That is, it's kind of weird, though. That the, one of the things I was thinking about when watching this is that they don't really mention who the women rockers are. Do they mention? I don't think they mention what bands they're from. And
no, they don't. They don't do the subtitles or explain who the women that get interviewed, like where they come from and their connection. Not really at all. But what I do think is interesting, if we're going to talk about like the sexual politics of this movie, is all the dudes are like kind of androgynous or like glam, and like also like wear makeup. So like they have an incredible amount of like misogyny, and there's probably a lot of homophobia just like kind of baked into it, but it's like it's just another thing. It's like they're like not even seeing themselves in a mirror, you know?
Right.
There's not much self-reflection going on.
No, there's not really.
But that's what makes them so entertaining in the movie.
Totally. Yeah, the lack of self-awareness. Yeah.
I had this thought. I was wondering if anyone who is in the first decline saw the second one.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least at the time.
Right. Yeah, because like punk and metal were a bit... Punk and arena rock were at odds. I guess arena rock is where I would put like Aerosmith, right? That would be kind of... Which is like adjacent, metal adjacent, or like in the Venn diagram, like metal could be arena rock or it could be like dirty club rock. But yeah, none of the punk bands really became arena bands from that first movie. I mean, X is probably the most commercially successful of the bands from the first decline. Probably just the ones that were friends with Penelope. I don't know whether this got much theatrical release. It probably didn't have the same screening issues that the first decline had.
No, like it wasn't. The LA, like, Daryl Gates wasn't like banning.
No.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. Yeah, this one's a little, it's less violent, but a lot more misogynistic and just creepy. And I mean, it's like another through line that I feel like she was trying to have here is like, it's almost like, I saw this article once describing this movie as like you remember the documentary, The Aristocrats?
Oh, yeah.
And so there's this joke that all the comics get a chance to tell up until the ending. And they were drawing a parallel between all the rockers.
Yeah.
Talking about wanting to get laid and pussy and so it was kind of that through line.
Yeah.
It's really kind of interesting when you watch this.
Yeah, right. They're all telling the same joke.
Yeah.
Just these songs. Yeah, in a way.
But then she also talks to some groupies, those two lovely ladies.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Did you go see...
Who are lying through their teeth.
Oh, you think?
Yeah.
Because
I think everybody in the movie's lying. Everybody in the movie's lying to a certain degree.
They reminded me of the two gals from Fargo. When she goes to Fargo.
Oh, yeah, the little one.
Oh, the little one. Oh, he's kind of weird looking.
Yeah.
Can you be more specific? I don't know, you know, just kind of weird looking.
They're either telling the truth or they're making it up 100%. Mm-hmm. I think they're making it up.
Oh, okay.
Because that's what, like, that's the image they want to give off.
Right.
So it's like if you say it enough, it'll come true or something.
Yeah, yeah. And like you put a camera in front of them. Like,
right.
This is like 1987, 88. Like they didn't have the ubiquity of cameras and documenting all.
And what was the theatrical release year for this?
Not sure.
I want to say it was probably 88.
I think it's definitely. I thought it was. Yeah, it could be 88. I wasn't quite sure either.
Footage is from 88, right? Because the contest is like for 88. Because the lady giving up her banner is 87.
Yeah, she's. Whew, she's something. Classy gal.
Yeah. Let's talk about the satanic panic angle that they address.
That cop.
So it comes off so dated and insane that they thought that this strain of music, that anyone thought this strain of music would bring about the downfall of society. It went from metal to hip hop with bands like Body Count.
Yes, that's the crossover.
Not really hip-hop.
Yeah.
To Marilyn Manson.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What musical movement today would garner that much paranoia? I can't think of anything.
I think that kind of subjugation of music, that paranoia that came up from the 80s, just I don't think it can exist anymore because...
Well, I mean, in the news just literally yesterday, people are freaked out about Marina Abramovich. Because John Podesta, Hillary's campaign manager, I guess, had a dinner with Marina Abramovich where she was like doing some kind of they hashtagged it as spirit cooking. So there's like literally a witch hunt in like on like in the news right now on the conservative left, on the conservative right side, like accusing Hillary of having like a coven.
Yeah,
of course. That's kind of Alex Jones level.
That's
horseshit.
That. Like, yeah, it's really.
I'm talking
insane.
About like
NBC News,
like moms,
yeah,
suburban Los Angeles household angst
right.
about listening to a subgenre of music.
Yeah,
I don't.
What would they fear the most?
Well, there was like the PMRC, and you know,
yeah, like, in the '80s,
literal congressional offshoots that were wanting to determine mm-hmm. how people are going to be able to listen to music. Matter of fact, one of the bands. I think it was Megadeth. I think the bass player had no to PMRC. He had a Dead Kennedys sticker.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. Someone had a Dead Kennedys sticker on their bass.
Sticker on his yeah. bass. Yeah.
I remember that. Yeah.
But the 80s was all about like parental, you know, groups telling kids what they should and should not.
Donahue. There was a lot of like these satanic fear things. I mean, we just did Hell House on the show, and that was like the year 2000, and that's maybe an extreme example, but there's like, you know, they're still like thinking that Harry Potter is demonic.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and that woman who I don't remember her name, she's pretty classic 80s, but yeah, the demeddling, I think she called it.
Oh yeah, the cop, yeah, the parole officer.
Yeah.
She knew so much about the bands though to start with. I'm like, "Oh, she knows more about these bands than I do."
Yeah.
That's a funny thing about like researching your enemy, you know, kind of.
I love too is like how she there's like a choker with medals, and she's like, "Oh, this is used so that if cops try to grab you around the neck, they won't be able to." And I'm thinking of like some 16-year-old kid being like, "This just looks fucking sweet." You yeah. know, they don't think of any political. Oh,
yeah, they saw somebody else wearing it in a music video.
Yeah. I actually like it was like that is a good idea. If I was like going to go into a protest, maybe I would want a choker.
That cop and that spiel she gives about metal accessories
armbands,
and
yeah.
like fashion and how it's dangerous is the only crossover point from Decline 1 to 2, because that's the kind of hysteria from law enforcement that you would probably find from the milieu of Part 1.
Right.
Anti-cops.
And I'm wondering if she went into that tangent thinking that there was going to be more of that, and then she went, "Oh, this scene is just so fluffy and dumb.
Right.
It's nothing like that." So
That's really smart.
I mean, I don't know. This is just me.
Well, she used that footage for a reason, too. So, like, yeah, I could see that being part of it. It's just after it was all said and done, they're getting the editing there. Like, you know, Odin doesn't stand a threat to the United States security.
Yeah.
Or neither does Seduce.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would bet you that if Penelope Spheeris was here and you said, "Oh, did you film that at the beginning of your shoot?" She would say, "Yeah, we were considering that as a tangent."
Right.
That's like as far as we went.
Yeah. That. Out of any of these bands, Brett, did you see any of them when you're a kid?
No. I started going to shows when I was in college. I mean, my first rock show was Fleetwood Mac at the Forum in 87. When I was 8 years old, my mom took me to see them.
Oh, whoa, yeah. That's pretty cool.
That era of Fleetwood Mac, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's a cool mom.
No, that was as cool as she got.
Oh, that was
she knew enough to take me.
Yeah.
You know?
Was that Tusk time?
No.
Tusk
87?
Yeah.
It's like, that's I want to be with you everywhere.
Oh, yeah. That's
like that Christine McVie lead, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What was your first show, George?
Shit. I went to see whatever version of the Beach Boys was going on in the mid-80s with my mom. It was like a family day thing. So it was not the... It was Mike Love, I guess, version of Beach Boys.
Okay.
I did not know the songs.
Uh-huh.
It was like there, just a child. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely some bands that stood out as being smarter than the other ones, and they seem to be the ones that have the success.
Yeah.
Go figure.
Yeah.
Megadeth. It's funny when the voice of reason is the band Megadeth. You know, like.
Yeah. Mustaine is always so controversial because he, like, whatever. A lot of stuff he says does sound right, but when it leaves his mouth, it sounds totally wrong.
Yeah.
Like, because he's such a. He gives off that jerk persona so hard.
Yeah, he really does.
And back then, he was coked to the gills, too.
Okay.
So
he was like, wasn't he? Yeah, so he was like kind of saying that he didn't really care about partying, but yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay, I didn't know that.
Oh, my God. Megadeth's story in the 80s is awash with as much drugs as the Rolling Stones.
Oh, really?
Oh, no. Like, they were doing a lot. If you just go to the VH1 Behind the Music on Megadeth.
So here's a little maybe a life hack for people who want to rewatch this is watch it and with the understanding that everyone's lying then. in this movie. It seems like then, like, everyone's just kind of making up shit.
Unreliable narrators,
yeah. Whether through drugs or ego, a lot of what they're saying. I mean, the only people that are saying anything kind of remotely truth-sounding is like when Steven Tyler says, "We must have snorted up all of Peru."
right.
Very, very honest about his drug use, but... Yeah.
So everyone's kind of like native to L.A., or at least gets their start in L.A., in this doc. I mean, I guess like Kiss, they're all living there by then. Like Ozzy is living there by then, and the Kiss people.
Seduce was from Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't really do
so
much.
Kiss, yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, Kiss just had the song Detroit. Okay. Detroit Rock City.
Where's Kiss from then?
I think L.A.
Oh, they are from L.A.?
Yeah. Okay. I think originally, or maybe New York.
Oh, Kiss are in New York.
Yeah.
New York outfit.
It made me think about Zolar X. Do you know about those guys? Yeah, like
yeah. How did that cross over?
Just like the way that Zolar X would kind of accuse Kiss of ripping off their gimmick.
Oh,
that was in the '70s.
Did you guys chuckle when Alice Cooper calls out Black Sabbath?
Oh yeah.
He goes. Penelope says something like, "What do you think about your imitators?" And he says something like, "Oh, they're cool. You know, a bunch of bands have ripped us off. Not going to name any names. Their initials start with," and then he says Black Sabbath, and they bleep it out.
Yeah. Oh, they did.
Yeah. I had to rewind it a couple of times to figure out who they were bleeping out. Yeah. Well, because Alice used to do shit with, well, it was a chicken, right? There was a chicken that they threw into the crowd that got mutilated by the crowd. I don't know if
that was just a one time.
I don't know if that was what he's referencing, but.
No, I think he's just talking about the shocking occult nature of some of the material.
Yeah.
You know, like Alice Cooper in the '70s had a guillotine on stage.
Right, yeah.
You know, very theatrical stuff. I think there's very little similarities between the two, because on an early Alice Cooper album they do a cover of Blue Rondo a la Turk.
Oh, sweet.
So Black Sabbath wasn't doing that.
They weren't doing Brubeck?
No.
They weren't covering any Brubeck. And then we find out, okay, so let's talk about Ozzy.
Yeah.
And his scene. So he's in some nice looking upper middle class home kitchen, making some eggs.
Yeah.
A little orange juice in a robe. Sounding like the old, Ozzy used to sound kind of normal.
Yeah.
You know, like you could understand him and stuff.
Yeah.
And then he's just talking about, he looks pretty good. He looks awake and he looks like he's gotten some sleep. And he's talking about the old years of being a rocker. But then I find out later that like the whole scene was just made up. Like that wasn't his kitchen. That was like a rental or something that they kind of. And then when he's pouring the orange juice and it spills, like apparently that was like just like a comic.
It's an insert. You don't actually see Ozzy pouring.
Yeah,
it's just a hand.
It's a hand,
and it's another example of a lot of the film being a fiction as opposed to the first one. But you don't mind because the fiction is so pleasing.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, it's an extremely entertaining documentary.
I think she was like, "I got Darby Crash making food. I got to have Ozzy making
food."
Yeah,
that was the conceit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you take a look at the special features at all? I wonder what.
Not for this one. I did for the first one, but
I'm wondering what the deleted scenes are.
Oh, I didn't bring it with, but I got the box set. I have not touched 3 yet. I haven't touched the third one.
3 is very tragic and touching.
Yeah,
and that is about.
It's about gutter punks in Hollywood in the.
Oh, that's right. I think I've seen that before.
Yeah, I mean, it's the one that she says she feels the most emotionally attached to.
Yeah, somebody in the cast of 3 she ended up in a relationship with for almost 20 years.
Whoa.
Yeah.
She's a fascinating woman.
Tell what more from that Q&A. Do you remember much from the Q&A?
You know, I don't, because it was like the questions were very general, because I think a lot of people in the audience hadn't seen the film before.
Mm-hmm.
But she's a fascinating woman. She went to film school here in L.A., did some really heavy-duty, experimental, awesome shorts in the late 60s and early 70s. And then, I believe in the later 70s, started a company that made proto-music videos.
Oh, right.
So she had a company, like, music videos weren't really a thing. So her company went to labels and said, "We will help make you promos for some of your artists."
Mm-hmm.
And then... most notably in the late 70s, a key credit of hers is as producer on the first Albert Brooks movie called Real Life.
Okay.
Which, if you haven't seen that, It is great.
It's one of my favorites. I love it.
Absolutely great. I hadn't seen it until recently, and I didn't know that the Albert Brooks film comedic persona started out akin to, like, Kenny Powers on Eastbound and Down. A true anti-hero, like, caustic, borderline evil, but you kind of go with it because he's so funny.
Yeah.
I didn't know that real life was such a, like, heavy-duty, like, fuck you.
Yeah.
Until I saw it, like, a year
real life ago. Is... one of my favorite movies. I love Albert Brooks.
I think I remember listening to Penelope's interview with Marc Maron, and wasn't she like hired to work on a Richard Pryor project? That was, I think, something from that I remember. Like, she was going to work on some Richard Pryor project that just never happened. Like, she spent like a lot. Like, I think he found her while she was at like USC.
Yeah. This story sounds familiar.
Yeah. So that's a good supplemental thing, is that Marc Maron, WTF. I would say.
And then she works for Corman in the mid-80s doing Suburbia and she did a couple other really low budget, very exploitation-y kind of films. One with Carrie Fisher, which I've been dying to see, called Hollywood Vice Squad. Mm. And then she gets the gig to do Wayne's World, and it changes her career. And then she ends up doing a movie with Chris Farley. I don't remember if it's Tommy Boy or the other one.
Mm-hmm.
And then she does Beverly Hillbillies and Little Rascals. What a career.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, she's been all over the place in her career, which is really pretty cool. And I do like as well, like, I've watched this now a few times, and I just kept seeing different themes, like the Lemmy juxtaposition of Lemmy with everyone else, basically.
Yeah. He's still the coolest.
Yes. Yeah, Lemmy is very cool. He's shot differently. His answers are different. It's not about, you know, kind of girls and drugs and, you know, making money. He seems like this, like, older...
Yeah, sage.
And this
wizard.
They filmed him up on this hilltop that they had filmed the Brendan Mullen interview.
Oh, right.
Same hilltop.
Oh.
And a friend of mine from Australia recently visited L.A., and he's like, can you help me find that hill? I want to take my picture up there. And
thought...
Actually, you know what? I would love to mount an outdoor screening of one of the declines on that hill.
Right.
And so I actually emailed Penelope Spheris.
That's
because
awesome.
I had talked to her for a couple other things before. And I said, where's that hill? Do you know if it's suitable to have a screening on? And she's like, nah, it wouldn't work because it's this like turn off on Mulholland.
Mm-hmm.
You can only park a couple cars there.
Right.
And then you have to hike up this hill. So there's no real easy way to get up there.
So she hiked up there with Lemmy.
With Lemmy. And my friend.
Small crew.
I basically forwarded my friend the info that she gave, because she didn't really remember the exact spot or address. And my friend did Google Earth and figured it out.
Oh, wow.
Took a picture on that hill.
That is awesome.
I never would have picked that up on that.
In doing research for this talk, I read that Lemmy thought that she shot him in a way that made him look like an asshole. And I feel like it comes across completely differently.
Yeah,
I feel like he comes across looking really good in this, you know.
Well, I can only imagine that if you're on that hilltop, it's hard to hear because of the traffic noise and the city noise. So she was probably shouting questions from across the hill at him. And he's like, what?
Uh-huh.
What's he talking about? What? And then he's like struggling to get through a weird interview where it's like, why are you filming me at like sunset?
Yeah.
Like when there's no light out.
Well, he was mentioning also that he's not shot in close up.
Like
it's a full body shot. I don't know. It's just weird.
It's framed against the skyline.
I think he comes across looking great. And he has these sweet white, I think, boots. Because they do there's a quick shot, and he's like white boots and bullet belt and the classic Lemmy, you know, jean jacket.
Takes credit for headbanging, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, I think we started it. We called them Mota Headbangers.
Yeah, Mota Headbangers.
Called them Hawkwinders.
He probably hadn't seen the first one, didn't know who she was, didn't know what the other people were going to look like when they were interviewed in the movie. Imagine you're Lemmy and you get asked to do that. What are you going to think?
What do you think about the pretty rock and roll stars?
Good luck to them if they're pretty. Wish I was.
Do you get mad if a band copies your style?
No. Good luck to them. Maybe they'll do something we can copy later.
Why did you get into rock and roll in the beginning?
Because I noticed that you got lots of girls. But I don't think people take girls seriously in this sort of music. I don't know why that is. I am actually an alcoholic now, I guess. I think I'm probably about 4 on the Richter scale of alcoholism.
Did rock and roll do it to you?
Well, yeah, I guess it did, because we got a free bottle backstage every show, you see, so... I mean, you don't want to leave, you know, the last quarter of the bottle, so you tend to finish it up, you know.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And this did really well, right, when it was theatrically released?
Not sure. I don't know. I don't know how, what kind of wide release it had, what cities it played in.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. Maybe they go into that. In the
it might be in here.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. It would be like, yeah, there's a bunch of different themes I felt like she was either purposely developed or just one of those magics of a good documentary where you see, you know, was there anything that you saw in this that struck you, Kurt?
Well, Brett, sorry. We should talk about the Chris Holmes thing, because that is the most, I guess, for people who haven't seen it, they might have heard of that scene. So Chris Holmes was the guitarist for Wasp, which were, like Alice Cooper, you know, they were into shock rock more than anything else. And sidebar, the 8x10 bass cab that I used to have in the early days of Anavan, my old band, used to belong to the touring bassist for Wasp.
Okay.
I bought it at Black Market Music, the now defunct vintage gear store in West Hollywood.
Did it have stickers on it, or you just could?
No, the guy who sold it to me told me that
nice.
The bassist from Wasp had sold it to him.
Connection to the doc.
Yeah. So Chris Holmes is a wastoid who is depicted in the film as living like a high on the hog rock star life. He's floating on like a pool mat,
mm-hmm.
and he's in full bondage, like metal rock star gear in the pool, and he's got a fifth of vodka, and he's just downing it. And his mother is sitting there, and I realized this for the first time watching it again. She's loaded too. She's drunk. She's got a fucking like screwdriver the size of like a tall boy can in uh-huh. her hand. So that's probably why she doesn't think the scene is so weird, because she's weird.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he gives this incredibly pathos-laden monologue about how he's a piece of shit alcoholic, and all he does is this all day, and he's going to die early.
Yeah.
So now you're saying that there's water in the vodka bottle.
Yes. Well, so there was apparently a few fifths of vodka, and I guess he was drunk, and he was drinking vodka, but later on when you see him pouring the vodka all over him, she said that was pool water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so
because
it caused quite a scene once this was released, but then she said, I think in an interview in 99, that it was just water.
Yeah.
She also said that like she thought that was an unusable footage and she wanted to redo the interview, but then this ends up being the thing where you leave it in and it's the thing people remember the most.
Yeah, she felt like she didn't get a good interview from him, and then was talking to her editors and was like, we need to reshoot that because I don't think I got a good, and they're like, we don't have money to reshoot that. So they left it in, and it's like the scene that really stands, because he's being really vulnerable. Like, yeah. I think part of why it really stands out is because he's being vulnerable, and it's really, you know, tragic to watch him sit there floating in one of those like little floaty chairs, you know,
with his mom there. That's the only other like kind of dynamic where you have that authority figure other than the cops. Well, and she's like going along with it. She's
yeah.
Like, yeah, my son's a piece of shit. It's great.
Well, at first I thought that the look on her, when I was a kid, the look on her face reads as a stern parent.
Right.
Now, as an adult who's seen people go through various stages like being wastoids, that look is like, I'm keeping it together for the camera. I'm trying really hard to seem like I'm not out of my mind.
Right.
Well, there's something to see a rocker with their parents. That would actually be a great table, a coffee table book,
mm-hmm.
you know, like the juxtaposition, you know, if, you know, like you see this drunk ass rocker who's in a pretty famous band. I mean, Wasp was huge. And then you see his like nice, you know, older middle class mom, you know, there's this weird, there's a whole lot of framing going on there, you know.
The lighting of that scene is really good too. Like, it's very well lit for a nighttime shoot. Like, it just looks really kind of stark and interesting as a visual.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then he just ends up flopping out of the chair into the pool.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's a wrap. Yeah. Can we get that microphone back? Yeah.
Yeah. I think she did obviously, like you guys said, there was 10 years difference between the first doc and this doc. But a lot of those little blackout, which is a theatrical term, like those like quick edits to make a joke or to punctuate a scene, she did a lot of those, you know, where she would cut on someone's weird line or on a weird moment, you know.
It's structurally a little more coherent, even though it's still kind of like when bands are introduced, they're sort of like, this is now we're going to focus on this band, as opposed to the first one where it's kind of like there were like clusters of things, but it was mostly like, okay, now we're going to talk to someone from the band and then show footage of their band playing. Is a little bit more like like you said earlier, thematic stuff.
Yeah,
like, touching on like just like what is success, drugs, sex, like just like work ethic, things like that.
Brett, do you think anyone comes away looking great in this?
Yeah, all the big rock stars. I mean, they're spewing some heavy knowledge, you know, and kudos to anyone who can make it through the entertainment industry alive.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
Especially at that time.
Mm-hmm. They talk about like AIDS even, at some point.
And
too.
Every single one of those huge rock stars, with the exception of Poison, they're all still around. Alice Cooper is still touring. Ozzy is still, I think, kind of touring. Aerosmith is still out there. Mm-hmm. Kiss is still out there.
Jesus, good point.
I know.
Until recently.
Is Megadeth still touring?
Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
Dave Mustaine is still active, and nobody in the band at the time is still in it, but Megadeth is still in it.
I think Chris Holmes is still playing.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
He's not dead.
No.
Good for him.
Yeah. As far as Wikipedia says.
I don't know what happened to Blackie Lawless, though.
I don't either.
that name used to always crack me up when I was...
Another thing I wanted to point out, and it's kind of like a secret factor, is this guy, Miles Copeland.
Right.
It's an IRS. So this is an IRS media film. Miles Copeland was the manager of the Police. And then... Stuart Copeland, the drummer's brother. And then he started his own record label and film company. They did Erg, A Music War, which is one of the... if I ever come back on the show, we're talking about that.
Yeah,
Erg's
great.
Erg, this movie, and then weirdo things in the 90s like Shakes the Clown and Reuben and Ed. Miles Copeland is an interesting dude.
Yeah, his Wikipedia thing was pretty fascinating. Like, because he was going to... he was a European tour booker, and he was supposed to bring out Lou Reed, and then Lou Reed just didn't show up. So that's why his first company for organizing touring bands fell apart. Just like Lou Reed just didn't show up.
And he was, you said, like the Police's
manager. On Wikipedia it was like him and Stuart, and they have a third brother, and they all grew up like their dad was like a oil guy or an army guy, so they grew up like speaking Arabic. Mm-hmm. And like now his label focuses on like world music, I guess.
Oh, weird.
It's interesting to note that Stuart Copeland's band was The Police. Miles Copeland's company is called IRS. I believe he had a management company called CIA.
Keep it all together.
There's something there. You ever see The Police?
I never got to see them. Did you?
I've never seen never seen Sting.
Yeah. I don't think I'd want to see Sting on his own at all.
He was just touring with Peter Gabriel.
That's a good mix.
I would pay to see that.
I'd pay to see Peter Gabriel.
Shoreline Theater.
Oh, yeah.
Like with a bunch of people with mustaches and Hawaiian shirts.
Do you remember Stuart Copeland was the house band leader for the Dennis Miller show.
Oh,
Dennis Miller
wow.
had a show in the 90s.
Ugh,
very
geez.
Strange.
I was actually involved in a live Shakes the Clown stage reading with
right,
the 20th anniversary of the film coming out with Bobcat and Florence Henderson.
Where was this? When was this? 5 years ago?
2 years ago at the at San Francisco Sketch Fest at okay. Cobb's. It was awesome.
Yeah, who else was there from the original cast?
Judy Brown, uh-huh. Florence Henderson, Dan Spencer, Rick Overton.
Kenny?
Huh?
Tom Kenny?
Tom Kenny was there.
Bobcat?
Bobcat was there, yeah.
What role did you get?
I did Tim Kazurinsky's role, Adam Sandler's role, a couple others.
Did you do a little Sandler?
I didn't do, no. Kevin Pollak was there, and he okay. did Robin Williams'
perfect
character, yeah. and he did it as Robin Williams.
Oh, you know? Of course, yeah.
It's funny we're bringing this up. I did a Q&A, like moderated a Q&A for Shakes the Clown a
oh,
few
yeah?
nights ago.
Oh, no way.
So this was at the Regent Theater. This is one of the many Alamo pop-ups that we
oh,
do.
Oh, cool.
So it was the 25th anniversary of Shakes the Clown, and Bobcat set it up with the venue, and I just came in and kind of helped out. So I was on stage with Tom Kenny, Bobcat, Dan Spencer, Blake Clark, and Adam Sandler.
Oh, wow.
Sandler did it.
It was one of those Q&As where I spoke three sentences and they just, you know, they
yeah.
went off. And
yeah, all those guys.
You
yeah.
pray for those.
Yes, yeah. yeah. That was just a few nights ago?
It was a couple nights ago.
Oh, that's awesome. Oh, that's yeah. so cool. Yeah, I was honored to be a part of that. I've known Dan Spencer for a bunch of years, and that was really fun.
Did they have any stories about Miles Copeland or this situation?
No,
IRS?
The Q&A did not veer into the nuts and bolts of making the film. It was purely just their reminiscences, yeah. and I think that's really what the crowd wanted to hear anyway.
I think, like, IRS also put out a lot of that early REM stuff, too.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, I guess they must still be a business functioning, at least with catalog or something like that. But, yeah, that I also thought that might be one of the reasons why this was held up. But, like you were saying, Penelope Spheres had the rights.
It's
time.
Just like it was. The movies are very personal for her, and for some reason, she just didn't want to deal with it. And yeah. it took major convincing. And luckily, we now have them kind of preserved for posterity.
Yeah.
How often does Alamo do show docs?
Oh, often. I mean, a lot of our locations outside of Austin are in suburban markets, so they don't get to do too much of that. But we just opened in San Francisco last year, and Brooklyn happened a week or two ago.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, LA is slated, like I said, sometime next year. And the big city Alamos will get to do that kind of stuff a little bit more often.
Do you want to say a little bit about, like, the organization?
Sure. What do you want to know?
Well, I know it started in Austin, and I don't know how many there are.
Oh.
Now. There's one in Seattle, I hear?
No, there's not one in Seattle. There's
Portland?
It started, no. Yeah.
just keep naming cities.
Like,
we're really in big coastal metropolises for the first time right now.
Yeah.
So it started in 97 in Austin as a single screen. And Alamo shtick is that it's centered around food and beverage at your seat in addition to like great presentation and no talking and no texting. They didn't invent it, but Alamo was the first chain to popularize nationally the whole dine-in seating thing.
The brew in view.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tim League, the CEO, owner, founder of Alamo Drafthouse, was kind of inspired by McMiniman's, which is a Portland thing, I think.
Okay.
But mainly started in Austin, and it's in a kind of a random smattering of suburban markets, and then like I said, just opened in San Francisco, Brooklyn, mm-hmm. LA is coming. There's like a Phoenix one coming. There's a downtown Denver one coming.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. That's,
yeah.
And I know like one of the things that they want to do is support the video stores that are in town. That's what they did in San Francisco.
In San Francisco, around the corner from where it opened in the Mission, Lost Weekend Video was going out of business or losing their lease. You probably have more insight mm-hmm. on it than I do. So Tim said, oh, you can use the space in our very spacious lobby. And so Lost Weekend Video is now operating out of our lobby. I don't know numbers or anything, but they're still there.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think it's a good foot traffic for sure.
Yeah.
Comparatively. But yeah, no, that's exciting that there's going to be a new location. And can you say anything about stuff that's planned for 2017?
We just don't really have anything planned.
Because you don't have this timeline set up.
Yeah, it's so far enough along that we're not making any concrete plans. In the meantime, like I said, we do pop-up events all over town, and mm-hmm. that's what I work on primarily is
yeah.
the execution of those.
Anything happening after January? I think this is probably going to run in January.
We don't have anything planned that far out, but I know that I will be doing more shows at the Regent because certain factors have just become easier for me to just straight up show movies there. So we'll be doing that more often. I've been talking to Blumhouse, the horror movie production company, about hosting regular horror screenings there. And I've learned after doing pop-ups for a whole year with just my own list and social numbers and stuff that really I should be doing them with solid promotional partners. And I think that'll be the focus of my 2017 is like partnering with other existing organizations to mount stuff rather than these random dotted events at different venues by myself.
Does Alamo, is it digital or do they have film projection?
Oh, both.
Both.
I mean, a lot of what I'm doing is digital because that's easier to mount in a pop-up style.
And there's some distribution that they've done also, right? Mm-hmm. Because like some of these cult films, I think came like they kind of. And I know you work with Zach Carlson a lot, or he was one of the old school people that was working in Austin.
Yeah, Zach was one of the old school Alamo people. The thing that he primarily does for Alamo these days is Fantastic Fest, which is this annual genre film festival they do in Austin. Mm-hmm. He's kind of one of the head honchos of that. But the company also had Drafthouse Films for a number of years, which was a film releasing arm. They're kind of closing that chapter to now start a more ambitious distribution company with other partners. And the first film that they're going to release under this new banner, well, they actually did one. It was the Michael Moore movie.
Okay.
But at the time, the company didn't have a name. So now that they're going to officially start with a new name for the company, they're doing this new movie called Colossal, which is with Anne Hathaway and Jason Sudeikis. Played at Toronto last year. It's kind of it's like an indie dramedy meets a kaiju movie.
Whoa.
So it's Anne Hathaway in like a really poignant, interesting movie about alcoholism and personal responsibility. And she's great in it, mixed with like Pacific Rim style, like robots and monsters battling each other on the other side of the globe and how those two things are tied together in a weird way.
Whoa, and it works?
Yeah. I thought it was great.
I think I read a blog post of yours talking about Canadian movies.
Ah, yes.
And I thought that was really interesting. I didn't realize that, like, the Canadian government basically gave people tax shelters.
Yeah, okay, so for the audience, this is a complete 180 total sidebar. I have been personally fascinated for years by Canadian movies of a certain time period, and that's, like, early 70s to mid-80s.
Mm-hmm.
And my thesis is that most people in America know more about Russia than they do about Canada. And I think that's very weird, especially when for film lovers and crate diggers and stuff, Canadian films of the 70s through the mid 80s are a fascinating, it's like just endless file folder drawers of weird stuff that you can rummage through. So the 2-minute version of the story is Canada up until the 70s had no native film industry except for documentaries and like short subjects. So there was the National Film Board of Canada, which you've probably seen on certain movies, like their stamp. And in 1970, it all changed with a movie called Going Down the Road, which has kind of been posited like it's a Canadian Easy Rider. It's not really that, but it's the closest equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first homegrown Canadian hit in theaters in Canada. So all of a sudden the government went, oh, wow, we can have a film industry if we just keep facilitating the production of these movies. So in the first half of the 70s, you get a lot of movies about kind of affable Canadian losers, like hosers, basically.
Right, right.
And so like they weren't as big of a hit as Going Down the Road, and the industry kind of floundered after that. So in 1975, I think, the government decided to increase their tax credit from 30% to 100%.
Wow.
So
that's insane.
If you've seen the movie The Producers, like the Mel Brooks movie,
yeah,
the scam that they pull happened en masse across the entire film industry.
That's insane.
So it was money laundering. If you were a Canadian dentist, say, and you had $2 million that you wanted to funnel into a tax shelter and you wanted to get every single dollar back, you just dumped it into a Canadian film production. Didn't matter if the movie made money. Didn't matter if it was completed or released or anything.
Wow.
So long as that you initiated a Canadian production in Canada with Canadian talent, you got 100% of your money back. And
that's insane.
So by 79 or 80, the government went, wait, what's going on? What are we doing?
Yeah.
And then they kind of repealed it After like Videodrome.
But people were making movies without a fearing money then, a budget, in a sense.
Yeah, kind of like, I'm sure budget and like artistic intent mattered, but for the money men, it didn't matter. So essentially every Canadian film of the period is an art film to some degree.
Wow.
Because financial considerations were really kind of out the window. And
that's where you get like your Dick Cronenberg starts.
Yeah, Cronenberg is the gateway drug into this. Mm. So everything from like Shivers to Videodrome kind of benefited from this thing. And that's why post Videodrome, his first movie is Dead Zone, which is like a Hollywood movie, because he knows, oh, the weird tax shelter financing is drying up. I got to finally go to Hollywood and like try it out. Wow. So that's where you get The Dead Zone, The Fly, right. Etc.
Yeah,
because he went to Hollywood finally.
Oh wow!
Like people like Adam McGoyan, that era. Or
that's post
a bit later. Yeah,
all the filmmakers that are Canadian that you know as like respected. Yeah. It's all post Tax Shelter
in '90s indie Canada yeah. film like Don McKellar.
Don McKellar, yeah. Guy Madden, mm-hmm. Sarah Pauly, Adam McGoyan. All these people cropped up after the Tax Shelter.
So like art genre films, kind of like or like horror, or like. Auteur films, kind of.
Auteur films, yeah. Genre films, yeah. Low-key character dramas, like unfunny comedies. They're all weird, sort of. Mm-hmm.
Canadian weird.
Canadian weird. They got a specific, distinct Canadian flavor, which is hard to articulate until mm-hmm. you've watched enough of them.
Mm-hmm. One was Rubber Gun.
Yeah, The Rubber Gun is my favorite Canadian movie.
I read your synopsis of it. I really want to see it.
Yeah, it's on YouTube. You can watch it right now. Directed by Alan Moyle, who did Times Square.
Oh, yeah, and Pump Up the Volume.
Pump Up the Volume, Empire Records. It's his first feature, and it's starring Stephen Lack, who you might recognize as the guy who acts poorly in Scanners. But that's because when he's called upon to act, he's not that good. But when he's called upon to be himself, he's a genius.
Is that Cronenberg? Scanners?
Yeah, Scanners. Oh. And it's... How do I describe this? Every... country has their own heroin drug movie subgenre movie. Okay. So it's like here we have like, you know, like those Paul Morrissey, Andy Warhol movies with Joe D'Alessandro where everyone's kind of smacked out. Mm-hmm. Or Germany, it's Christian F. Or
heroin aesthetics.
Heroin aesthetic. Yeah. Every country has their heroin aesthetic movies. This is Canada's heroin aesthetic movie, and it's genius. It's kind of a cross between... the looseness of Cassavetes, the realness of Cassavetes, the kind of heightened camp of John Waters, the weirdo personas of Warhol, and this kind of unique Canadian flavor all mishmashed into one.
Wow.
Barely has a plot. It's kind of like there's a duffel bag full of drugs at a bus station locker that the cops are watching. That's the kind of like genre hook on which this movie hangs. And it's not about that at all. It's really about this weirdo group of misfits who kind of all band together and hang out with each other.
It sounds awesome.
Fascinating.
Where can we find this blog post?
I think I did it for Rupert Pupkin Speaks.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
That guy, Brian Sauer.
We can put it in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll put a note.
Yeah, he's cool. You should get that guy out.
Okay. Yeah, we'll figure that out. Like, yeah. Booking.
Well, this has been great. Thanks so much for coming in and talking to us, Brett.
Yeah. I mean, it's what I do. I talk about movies.
Thanks a lot, Brett.
Thanks. Yeah.
Thanks for listening.
You can find more episodes of SupDoc, show notes, updates, and more at supdocpodcast.com.
We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at supdocpodcast.
If you have comments, corrections, or want to suggest a documentary, email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.
The show is listener supported. You can donate to the show at patreon.com/supdocpodcast.
If you can't donate financially, please subscribe, comment, or tell a friend about SupDoc.
We'd like to thank Documentary News for their ongoing support.
SupDoc is produced by Will Scovel.
Our theme music is by David Siegel.